Live from New York City, it's The Gary Null Show. And now, your host, Gary Null.
Hi, everyone. I'm Gary Null. Nice to have you with us today. To address the missile attack by the President of the United States on Syria a little later on in the program. I have a special guest coming up, Professor Rebecca Gordon. She is the Professor of Political Philosophy and Theories of Justice at the University of San Francisco. She is also associated with the School of Leo McCarthy for Public Service and Common Good. And she has been a national advocate for international peace and justice movements, including the anti-apartheid movement in the United States and South Africa, and the liberation struggles among the poor in Central America, and much of the 1984 war zones out of Nicaragua, and other efforts. She's an anti-war activist. She will be here to talk about the U.S. military response to Syria and Trump's tactic in consolidating power from this act. Also, today we'll have commentary from Professor Michael Chofsadovsky from Global Research on the Pentagon trained Syria's al-Qaeda rebels that we supported to use chemical weapons. We have proof of that. No other media in the world will present it. We will, coming up. Also today, we'll give you the latest on health and healing, including what's in your tea that could be helping you prevent dementia from the National University of Singapore. And a clinical trial shows the benefit of yoga helping those who are receiving prostate cancer treatment who have... This is from the University of Pennsylvania School of Medicine. Also today, we'll be looking at where your blood actually come from. Most people thought they knew. Well, Lund University in Sweden begs to differ, and I'll tell you why that's important. From the Federation University of Australia, combining the omega-3 fatty acids with microencapsulated probiotics gives a higher survival rate. That's good news. I'll explain that in lay language. And pet exposure can reduce your allergies and obesity. University in Canada. And also today, a study examines using a lubricant made with seaweed extract to protect against the papillomavirus infection from Reuters University. From our audio file, Eva Bartlett, in my opinion, one of the most courageous, honest journalists on the planet, will be here to talk about what's actually going on in Syria. And the ex-United Kingdom ambassador, Peter Ford, will state on today's program that Assad was not behind the chemical attacks. And also, the media wants you to focus on Syria and look not at Yemen. Why? So we'll talk about that. And the Syrian woman exposes the foreign backers of the rebels that we support, Saudi Arabia supports, in Syria. And that is a piece that you have heard before. So we have a lot of unique insights that, well, the mainstream share with you. That's their loss, but your gain. You're going to get the truth. Let's begin with health and healing. We know that various herbal teas are very good. At the top of the list of teas actually studied into the thousands of studies are the green tea, oolong tea, white tea, and black tea. Drinking tea reduces the risk of cognitive impairment by 50%, as much as 86% of older adults who have a genetic risk of Alzheimer's. This is according to a study. Quote, while the study was conducted, the results could apply to other races as well. These were Chinese. Our findings have important implications for dementia prevention. And despite high-quality drug trials, effective pharmacological therapy for neuroprotective disorders such as dementia remains elusive, and current prevention strategies are unsatisfactory. Tea is one of the most widely consumed beverages in the world. The data from our study suggests that a simple and inexpensive lifestyle measure, such as a daily tea drinking, can reduce a person's risk of developing neurocognitive disorders in later life. And this was published in the Journal of Nutrition. So, in order to protect your brain, you have the tea. Why? What's in a green tea? Several things. You have L-theanine, which helps you relax. You have theoflavins. You have catechins. And you have theonuberogens, all of which are protective to your brain. From the University of Pennsylvania, they did a study for men. Men who attended a yoga class twice a week, cancer treatment, reported far less fatigue and better sexual and urinary than those who didn't. This according to tea done at the Perelman School of Medicine at the University of Pennsylvania and published in the International Journal of Radiation, Oncology, Biology, and Physics. So something simple, easy. Also, most of the men who are going to have prostate cancer are going to be in their 50s, 60s, 70s, and 80s. By that time, most men are very stiff. Their muscles are stiff. They don't stretch them. So the yoga would also help loosen you up and make you far more flexible and fluid in your movements. So it's good on both ends. And the yoga sessions were about 75 minutes twice a week. And that's important because a lot of men getting radiation therapy also become impotent during that period of time. And they said that this wasn't the case here. I'm always fascinated by blood and how we produce it, but more importantly, from my perspective, how we can increase its quality of life. Scientists from Lund University in Sweden have developed a new understanding of how the cells form during human development as they transition from endothelial cells to form blood cells of different types. And using a laboratory model of human stem cell development, and by looking at the expression of blood cells and endothelial cell genes in each individual cell, they found a progression from an endothelial state to a mixed endothelial blood state to a blood-only state. And this was the first study showing a molecular process of this transition in the human developmental context. Quote, understanding how the first human blood cells develop will provide missing clues for us to generate blood stem cells in the laboratory for use in the blood disorders and malignancies. See, the blood running through your veins right now, it's composed of billions of specialized cells responsible for many important functions required for life, including providing oxygen to all tissues in your body and providing immune responses against viruses and bacteria and even cancer cells. And during a narrow window of time, embryonic development, the first stem cells form, and these give rise to all the blood cells you'll produce in your lifetime. And the birth of these blood stem cells is a transition from another cell type into the blood cells, a process known as endothelial transition. So the cells undergoing the transition to blood in the embryo start as endothelial cells, make up the walls of the developing arteries. And during a short temporal window in development, the small number of tightly packed spindle-shaped endothelial cells are rolled up, forming nascent blood, and then detached and are released into the circulation. I just thought it was important because once we understand how blood is actually formed, where the blood cells come from, then we should go to the next state. We've been led to believe that whatever cells you have at birth, with the exception of skin and some liver cells and your intestine cells, that's it. You don't have any more for the rest of your life. So when you damage cells, let's say you get radiation, some other kind of damage, those cells are damaged forever. Now let's say that your cells, we'll just use an average. Let's say that the average in your heart or your brain or your muscle, that that cell can divide about every 2.5 years, and about more or less 40 to 50 times, then theoretically, you should be able to live between 120 to 150 years. Now, no one disputes this math. That's been fairly well established. So then why are you living in poor health if you're the average person into your 60s and mid-70s at best? And that's because we now know absolutely positively that many can be changed to, rebuilt, redesigned, reconfigured as if they got a frame-off restoration. I love going to old car shows. And where I live, once a year, all on a Saturday, they bring all their old cars downtown. And then it's just fun going from car to car. There's probably 500 of them going over about 8 blocks. And the guys tell you the whole story of the car. And almost without exception, these are real aficionados. These are people that will go out into a junkyard, buy an old demolished car that has an initial beginning pedigree, bring it back and painstakingly rebuild it. Now, it might take an average 4 to 5 years. But they love doing that. It gives them a lot of joy. And you know, they enjoy it. And generally, they'll sell it another one. They like the process. And I picked up one of those 7 Chevy convertibles, 100-point restoration. And you drive downtown, you pull up and you go for a walk and come back, and there are like 15 people. And they all want to look under the hood, and they all want to look in. And it's just wonderful to see people so interested. Yet here we have our bodies, and we have our bodies where someone has reversed the aging process or reversed the disease process. And to give you an example, I was invited to be a keynote speaker at a scientific conference to explore a support group that I did, a health support group. I've done over 42 of these. And you have to follow very rigorous standards, and then you have to have an outside independent medical to do the analysis to see whether it worked or didn't and to what degree. And then you submit it to different journals, and then from there, if you've done something really unique, you're generally invited to present it before a lot of other people so that they can also hopefully replicate your findings. So at this particular one down in Washington, D.C., there were about, I'm guesstimating, around 5,000 scientists. And it's rather boring. You get up on a stage, and there's a big screen behind you. And when you're talking, your study is that, and they have it all on their computers. And so it's really just reading it at the very end. There might be a few questions and answers, and that's it. But on this particular day, I had done a long study. It was a 16-month study. And instead of dealing with the abstract, I asked them to turn on the lights. Lights came up, and I said, I'd like to interview some people. And I brought out a young man, Jonathan Ortega. He was there with his parents, who are both New York City police officers, out of Bed-Stuy. And I said, Jonathan, what do you got in your hand? He said, outstanding student of the, I think it was the week or the month, for the last 10 months. And what are your hobbies? And he was telling about, playing the guitar and the piano and making breakfast for his family and throwing a ball with his dad and the normal things a teenager would do. Except he wasn't a normal teenager. Until he started the protocol, he was not able to speak. He would grunt. He had advanced end-stage autism, where you're too big to be left at home and cared for, and you're put in an institution. He was already on 4 antipsychotic medications, and they were going for a 5th depressive, which could have killed him. So he told his story, and then out came a woman who had advanced Alzheimer's and had reversed all the major symptoms of Alzheimer's. And she was able to get her cognition back, her memory back, her word association back, and she shared her story. And then the person who didn't have a chance to get out was a plumber who had completely reversed end-stage multiple sclerosis. And the last person came out had reversed at least 5 life-challenging illnesses that would have killed them, like hepatitis B and mycoplasma and breast cancer and ovarian cancer. They all did the same. And so when we finished the talk, I just thought, all we're talking about at all the scientific conferences, and I've gone to many and presented at many, is we talk about stem cells and we talk about funding and you need 5 million, 20 million to do this, and it's going to take this amount of years before we have a rat model that can show some improvement and maybe be the hippocampal region of the brain. And here we have a whole brain rebuilt. All frustration. This is a 57 Chevy human being, completely frame off restored, drives like new. Now, why don't you find your curiosity and take a look? And with that, when I left stage, about 700 people came out in the hallway. We're talking with these people. Single scientist followed up. I said, you're welcome to come to New York. You're welcome to sit in the room while I counsel people to see the process, the protocols. You know, you're welcome. Not one person. Now, that leads me to 2 issues. One is, do we really want to learn anything if, in the process of learning that, it challenges the dominant theory by which we have been so certain about our science or economics or body politic or teaching, whatever it may be? And I think not. I've been down that road so many times that I've seen people who are well-intentioned, nice people, but who will not in any way surrender 1 millimeter of their existing belief system. They resist. So if you, anything, just visualize this. Visualize 2 million scientists are dedicated to overcoming, working in the medical complex, getting grants, frequently working for universities, and so the lifestyle is not in question. Their future is not in question. Whether or not they will achieve what they're seeking is what's in question. And imagine then that they're all pushed forward and they're resisting. They're digging in their heels. And now you've got someone behind them saying, what if what you're doing is not the full picture? Would you at least be open to other points? No. What do you have to lose? And then you get into the complexity of denialism. And it is the dominant energy in science, medicine, dietetics, healthcare, in our society. So it wouldn't matter how many people were cured and brought to these places. I took 12 completely 100% cured AIDS patients who had advanced AIDS. We worked with them for 16 months, worked with them 5 days a week, paid for their therapy. They didn't lay out a penny. And then we took them to a press conference with physicians and 100 other people who had been improved doctors. Not a single member of the media or the AIDS community showed up. Because ours was not the pharmaceutical approach. Ours was not the patented drugs. Ours was vitamin C drips at high doses, herbs, neolites, zeolites, I should say, from homeopathic solution, juicing, bitter melon. None of that could compete against one drug, one single drug, ADT. That's where the billions of dollars were. That's how they bought the influence of different age groups and gay groups, and that's where the division came. One group supporting the pharmaceutical approach, which would be the dominant and only approach. Everything else had to be rejected, destroyed, or denigrated. And that's why now you'll start to see a major effort to destroy organic in the legitimacy of it, meditation, mindfulness, the very things that for the last 50 years we've been showing incrementally increasing belief and benefit and science to support, but it's now cutting into profits of other industries. Do you do meditation or do you take tranquilizer? One costs you nothing. The other is going to be a lifelong addiction, but that's where the money is. Do you detoxify your blood? Do you show you can rejuvenate blood cells by green juices, wheatgrass juice and barley grass juice? Or do you get dialysis? So I'm seeing that major effort with trolls to destroy people's reputation, the completely, in my personal opinion, the worst trash place you can get information in the world is WikiLeaks. That's my personal opinion. And behind it, I believe, is the CIA and other organizations that have used it against every single person in the alternative movement. And yet try to correct any of the mistakes, they'll never allow you to correct it. So what they're doing is they're trying to do the group think, a consensus of easily manipulated and easy for hire scientists and physicians who will say, get your vaccinations. You know, exercise really is not that important. Organic's no different. Drink fluoridated water. Get your mercury fillings. Everything that's bad, they'll say is good. Everything is good, they'll say is bad. Now, this audience is wise enough and learned enough and has the documentation to know otherwise. But just imagine if you're that big group out there that are still susceptible to groupthink. Watch it happen in the upcoming years. Finally, from the Federation University of Australia, combining the omega acids with probiotics, especially in this case if it's not a liquid, if it's a capsule or powder, you get a higher survival rate. Quote, when a probiotic is co-encapsulated with omega-3 fatty acids, not only do the bacteria adhere better in the intestinal wall, but more chemically intact omega-3 fatty acids are released from the oil. Okay? Well, in lay language, here's how you do it. You just take your omega-3s in the morning with your probiotics at the same time. It's that simple. That's the latest on health and healing. I'm Gary Nall. Back in a moment. Please stay with us. Nice to have everyone. I'm going to take a few minutes. I'm going to share a report. It's a short report from a professor, and this is one of the most prominent professors I know of, Michael Chosudovsky from Global Research. Media reviews their own eyes. Not only do they confirm that has been training the terrorists in the use of chemical weapons, they also acknowledge the existence of a not-so-secret back plan to launch a chemical weapons attack on Syria and blame it on Assad's regime. From the London's Daily Mail, in a 2013 article, confirmed the existence of an Anglo-American project endorsed by the White House with the assistance of Qatar to wage chemical weapons attack on Syria. Place the blame on Bashar al-Assad. Article was published and subsequently removed. Note the contradictory discourse. And here's what it says. The Pentagon's training of rebels, such as al-Qaeda terrorists, and the use of weapons, CNN accuses Bashar al-Assad of killing his own people while also acknowledging the are not only in the possession of weapons, but these moderate terrorists affiliated with al-Nusra are trained in the use of chemical weapons by specialists on to the Pentagon. In a twisted logic, the Pentagon's mandate was to ensure that the rebels felt Al-Qaeda not acquire or weapons of mass destruction, but actually training them in the use of weapons. Sounds contradictory. Quote, the chemical weapons, which is taking place in Jordan and Turkey, monitor and secure stockpiles and handle materials, according to sources. Of the conflict are on the ground in Syria rebels to monitor officials. The nationality of the trainers was not disclosed. Off cautious, assuming all are. Now, the above report by CNN's award-winning Elise Labbitt, relegated to the status of a CNN, refutes CNN's accusations directed against was doing the training of terrorists in chemical weapons. Versus mouth, quote, the U.S. Syrian rebel training on chemical weapons. The same terrorist training on the alleged Washington terrorist campaign initiated by in August 2014. Quote, the Pentagon's in 2012 consists equipped and the use of chemical weapons with support of military contract Pentagon and then hold hearing responsible for using weapons of mass destruction against people. What is in a diabolical scenario, which is an internal part of the planning, namely a situation of opposition terror advised by Western contractor in possession of weapons. This is not rebel training exercise in non-proliferation. While President Obama states, quote, you'll be accountable if you government use weapons, what is contemplated as operation is the possession of weapons by the U.S. NATO sponsors, our affiliate, including al-Nusra, which constitutes the most effective Western finance and fighting group integrated by foreign mercenaries. In a bitter twist, al-Nusra, a U.S.-sponsored intelligence, they put on.
The whole debate is ignoring the main point here, which is that the rebel uprising or the democratic uprising is not that. It's a Muslim Brotherhood uprising. The Muslim Brotherhood was the main opposition group in Syria for the last 40 years. And they are the ones that want to remove the secular government. Yes. And I'm not a government supporter. I'm for the reform process, just like the majority of the Syrian people. But the fact is, the fact is, it is the American and NATO governments and Israel that are funding these Al-Qaeda terrorists and Muslim Brotherhood extremists. And that is the point that everybody here is missing. And the fact is that, excuse me, sir, but you do have a stake in Syria because we have Russia emerging as a superpower and you have China emerging as a superpower and you want, and America and NATO want to control the Mediterranean Sea. They want to cut off this new pipeline deal that is happening between Syria, Iraq, and Iran. They want to cut off ties between Syria and Iran, which is why these people hate Iran so much. And this is why these sectarians are against any unity between Syria and Iran, because they want to see Syria get destroyed. And that is what this is about, Syria.
Fine. Mimi, what sort of government do you want?
Of course, I would like to see a government that has less corruption, but also maintains our foreign policy, which is of the utmost importance, because we have an imperialist Zionist entity right next door to us, Israel, which is funded by NATO, and the whole crisis is being created by our enemies, Israel, NATO.
And that, I'm switching over to a different phone. I have, I'm on the road, so please excuse the technical quality today. So he's a person in the loop. He would know. Now let's hear from Eva Bartlett, one of the best journalist in the world who's been multiple times in the fire zone. She's been in Aleppo when the rebels were there. And no American journalists were. No one from CNN, MSNBC, from Fox. Yet they were claiming that they knew what was going on there. And who were their sources? Well, they were rebel sources. And who legitimized the rebel sources? Well, the CIA and the White House and the Pentagon and the National Security Agency. And we've said all along, you cannot have a moderate terrorist. And that's who we've been funding. So let's hear from Eva Bartlett right now.
When you talk about the Syrian people and what the Syrian people want, how can you quantify that? Do you have any independent surveys where you can actually document that? And secondly, you talk about the corporate media, the Western media, the lies, and all of this. Could you explain what you think might be the agenda from us in the Western media, and why we should lie, why the international organizations on the ground should lie, why we shouldn't believe all these absolutely documentable facts that we see from the ground, these hospitals being bombed, these civilians who are talking about the atrocities that they have been experiencing. How can you justify calling all of us liars? Thank you.
I mean, there are certainly honest journalists amongst the very compromised establishment media. Let's start with your second question. So, international organizations on the ground. Tell me which ones are on the ground in Eastern Aleppo. Yeah, okay, I'll tell you. There are none. There are none. These organizations are relying on the Syrian Observatory for Human Rights, which is based in Coventry, UK, and which is one man. They're relying on compromised groups like the White Helmets, which let's talk about the White Helmets. The White Helmets were founded in 2013 by a British ex-military officer. They have been funded to the tune of $100 million by the US, UK, and Europe and other states. They purport to be rescuing civilians in Eastern Aleppo and Idlib, yet no one in Eastern Aleppo has heard of them. And I say no one, bearing in mind that now 95% of these areas of Eastern Aleppo are liberated. The White Helmets purport to be neutral, yet they can be found carrying guns and standing in the dead bodies of Syrian soldiers. And their video footage actually contains children that have been recycled in different reports. So you can find a girl named Aya who turns up in a report in month, say, August, and she turns up in the next month in two different locations. So they are not credible. The SOHR is not credible. Unnamed activists are not credible. Once or twice, maybe, but every time, not credible. So your sources on the ground, you don't have them. As for your agenda, not your, but the agenda of some corporate media, it is the agenda of regime change. How can the New York Times, I was reading it this morning, or how can Democracy Now!, which I was reading the other day, maintain until this day that this is a civil war in Syria? How can they maintain until this day that that the protests were unarmed and nonviolent until, say, 2012? That is absolutely not true. How can they maintain that the Syrian government is attacking civilians in Aleppo when every person that's coming out of these areas occupied by terrorists is saying the opposite? How do I quantify the support of the Syrian people? The elections. In 2014, the Syrian people held elections. The point being, overwhelmingly, the people support President Assad. There are people that want change in the government. We're not pretending they don't want change. Everybody wants change. But in terms of support of the government, the point is they don't see President Assad as the problem. They see the problem as terrorism. They see elements of problems in the system that they have there. But President Assad, they don't see as the problem. They actually overwhelmingly support him. So I'm basing it on their choice in their leader, and I'm basing it on my interactions with people in Syria.
And that's Eva Bartlett. A very courageous and honest journalist, more than I can say for most of the mainstream media journalists. And finally, a short piece on how the media wants you to focus on Syria and ignore Yemen. And why are we not talking about the dead in Yemen? Why not talk about how America's drone and regular strikes in the support of Saudi Arabia strikes have decimated whole communities, creating one of the worst humanitarian crisis in the world. Not a word of condemnation towards Obama or now towards Trump. Listen in, please.
The world is up in arms over Syria. Aleppo, airstrikes, Assad, nonstop media coverage. A tremendous humanitarian crisis. Possibly the worst in the Middle East? Nope, that's Yemen. 19 million people are in need of some kind of humanitarian assistance there. That's around 70% of the population. Why doesn't the media cover this? Surely it's an important story. Yemen is a battlefield for influence between two regional superpowers, Saudi Arabia and Iran. Iran backs Houthi rebels, and they booted the Saudi lapdogs out of power. So in March 2015, the Saudi-led coalition started attacking Yemen and imposed a naval blockade to bomb the Houthis. More than 8,000 airstrikes have been carried out since then. Over 10,000 people killed. Around half of them were civilians, the majority of whom were killed by Saudi airstrikes, according to the UN. And yes, bombing civilians is a war crime, but we don't hear much about that either. All of this bombing would never be possible without the Saudis' good old buddy, America, which supplied Saudi Arabia with cluster bombs and other bombs and still helps them refuel their fighter jets, plus provides intelligence for the kingdom. This is not to mention that Yemen, which has to import 90% of its food, fuel, and medical supplies, is currently on the brink of famine due to a Saudi port blockade. So why do we only hear about Syria?
And a legitimate question. Now let's go out to our guest in the San Francisco Bay Area and say hello to, I gave you her bio a little earlier in the program, Professor Rebecca Gordon. Nice to have you with us today.
Happy to be here.
Well, you've heard some of these, and like a lot of us, we rather anticipated that Trump and his Mad Dog Mattis, the head of defense, and other people who are the neocons that dominate the current administration and the last administration and the one before that and the one before that. In fact, clear back to Ronald Reagan, that we would not look at diplomacy nor first look for the truth before action was implemented. And so please address the following issues, if you would. For those who have studied the Syrian civil war for any length of time, including Russia's actions and U.S. support behind jihadist rebel groups, how feasible is it that Assad would have ever intentionally used chemical weapons on his people? And he still has enormous approval ratings among Syrians, including Sunnis. So none of this makes sense. Your thoughts?
Well, let me start by saying that I hold no particular grief for Bashar al-Assad. I've spent a little bit of time in Syria, not very much, and that was some years ago. And I can tell you it was definitely a police state. That said, I think that we need to go back into the, as you point out, the plans of the neocons for remaking the entire Middle East. And so, excuse me, when Dick Cheney and Paul Wolfowitz and that group came into George W. Bush's administration, they came in with a plan which began with toppling Saddam Hussein in Iraq and then moving on to destabilizing Syria with an ultimate goal of remaking the Middle East in some kind of form that would actually suit U.S., frankly, oil interests better than the one that existed at the time. None of this took into any account the actual lives of actual people in Iraq, in Syria, and I was very glad to hear you play that last clip about Yemen, and I'd be happy to say a little bit about that as well. So in terms of what Bashar al-Assad might or might not do to his own people, honestly, I can't tell you. But what I can tell you is that whatever is going on in Syria, and I disagree with your journalist, Ms. Bartlett, I do think there is a civil war going on in Syria. Whatever is going on, I can guarantee you it is not going to be made better by throwing U.S. missiles into the mix. I'm also very concerned about the rule of law in my own country back here in the United States. And I think that, you know, in beginning with Ronald Reagan and coming down to the present, we have seen a gradual enlargement of the powers of the presidency. And the consequence is that the power in the Constitution that belongs to Congress to declare war has completely eroded. And so I was pleased to see Nancy Pelosi, my congresswoman, actually call on Paul Ryan to bring Congress back from recess to decide whether or not they were going to actually authorize Donald Trump to start a whole new U.S. war without any kind of discussion or authorization. And let me just say about Trump, I had a piece out from Tom Dispatch this week, and part of it I refer to a wonderful Russian journalist named Masha Gessen, who now lives in the United States, and she had a piece early on in the Trump administration, which she says, we should believe the autocrat. When an autocrat says that he is going to do something, he is going to do it. So Donald Trump looks at a bunch of pictures and suddenly decides, oh my God, dead children, I have to do something. I think we should believe that that's exactly what happened. Now, there are other people behind Trump who might be in a position to manipulate him a little bit. But the truth is that the person at the top, the person that we've, some of us, not I, have elected, really is as uninformed and impulsive as he appears to be. And this is why we need to see some grown-ups start to rein him in. And by grown-ups, I do not mean the national security establishment that he's put around him, nor do I mean Steve Bannon. So I think that there's another thing that your listeners might be interested in, and this sort of gets into my area, which is international humanitarian law, which sounds really boring, but what it really is the law about what people can and can't do to each other in war. And the International Committee of the Red Cross came out with a statement today that was in the UK Guardian, in which, and they're the ones who administer the Geneva Conventions. They said that because the United States has entered the war with this attack, it now moves, our involvement now moves from one status to another, and it's now an international conflict. And what that means is that a different section of the Geneva Conventions now apply, which means we have different responsibilities for how we treat, well, not civilians, but how we treat anybody that we capture in the context of that war. They are now entitled to a different and higher level of protection than they would have been entitled to otherwise. The one last thing I'll say is that if the United States really had a concern about the people of Syria, then the United States would have opened its arms to the 4 million refugees. Syria only has a population of about 22 million people. 4 million of them are now external refugees. Another 12 million are internal refugees. That is, they no longer have a home to live in inside their own country. So, you know, over half the people of that country have been made into refugees as a result of this conflict. We could have opened our arms to the people we have made homeless through our own neocon policies. And instead, what President Trump, who suddenly now cares about the Syrian people, has said is, we will allow no refugees into the United States, especially including refugees from Syria. So I have to say it's a little bit rich for him to suddenly achieve this concern about the death of children, which I also care about very much, but there are children who are unable to live in refugee camps, who are dying in the desperate attempt to get from North Africa into Europe. And Trump's answer to that is, we can't allow them into the United States because they might be a risk. So I'm having a hard time squaring the concern with one group of Syrian children with the lack of concern for a whole, you know, millions of Syrian children.
All right, let's address a few of your points in a little greater depth, if you would, please.
Absolutely.
Since the beginning of conflict after the Cold War, during the Cold War, but after the Korean War, when we got into Vietnam, can you name me a single American official in the government, including in the military, who was responsible for nearly 2.5 to 3 million deaths? I've seen none of those individuals held accountable, nor in the accountable for the weapons of mass destruction. And as you know, there's no statute of limitations against crimes against humanity. And yet no one ever seems to be held accountable.
That's exactly right. And not only that, I would say that the U.S. Congress was completely derelict in its duty in allowing an entire hideous war that involved, you know, which was basically picking up France's colonial aspirations and making them our own after the French were thrown out of Vietnam. Absolutely. That nobody has been held responsible, and that includes Richard Nixon, now deceased. That includes Henry Kissinger, who I understand is now informally advising the Trump White House. And that certainly includes all the other people who committed terrible war crimes. And that, you know, my particular area of expertise is torture and the institutionalized use of torture by states. And so if we want to talk about Vietnam, we have to talk about the Phoenix program, which involved the deaths of somewhere between 10 and 30,000 people, many of whom were thrown alive out of helicopters into the South China Sea. And no, nobody has ever stood trial for those crimes. And if you want to come further, there have been a number of other U.S. military interventions, which, you know, other people might call wars, except we didn't declare them, since the Vietnam War. And again, nobody has been held accountable for those war crimes. And I think that, you know, I have a book called American Nuremberg. And one of the things that I say in this book is that what happened at Nuremberg after World War II, as imperfect, and it was imperfect, as the process was that the United States, Great Britain, France, and the Soviet Union established a principle, which is that international law is real law, and it has real effects and real meaning. And it was hoped that after that tribunal, there would be an international court that would be set up that would permanently be in position to adjudicate these war crimes. It took 50 years, 60 years, but eventually such a court was established, the International Criminal Court. In 2002, George W. Bush had Donald Rumsfeld, who was our Secretary of Defense at the time, send a letter to the ICC saying the United States was withdrawing our signature and that the Senate was never going to ratify the treaty that created that court. Essentially, they knew that they were going to be in the business of committing war crimes and that they were, in fact, already in that business, and they did not want to see members, anybody from the United States, put on trial in an international court that was imposing international law. Congress came along afterwards and passed a law saying that it would be illegal for anybody in the United States to assist the ICC in bringing any U.S. citizen to trial at The Hague. And furthermore, this is unbelievable, but furthermore, that the U.S. military forces would be brought to bear if anybody actually was put on trial at the International Criminal Court. Some of us at the time called it the Invade The Hague Law. So you're absolutely right that unlawful war making, war crimes on the part of the United States goes back, you know, at least as far as the Vietnam War. And the truth is that along with Nazi Germany and Japan, the United States also committed war crimes during World War II. At some
Rebecca, let me get one final little audio clip here that is relevant. I believe it's relative to why we are trying to get regime change in Syria. This is a former four-star general. He was the supreme commander of NATO. He is retired General Wesley Clark, revealing an interesting conversation he had with a fellow general at the Pentagon just a few days before. Right,
hey there.
After 9/11.
About 10 days after 9/11, I went through the Pentagon and I saw Secretary Rumsfeld and Deputy Secretary Wolfowitz. I went downstairs just to say hello to some of the people on the Joint Staff who used to work for me. And one of the generals called me and he said, "Sir, you got to come in. You got to come in and talk to me a second." I said, "Well, you're too busy." He said, "No." He says, "We've made the decision. We're going to war with Iraq." This was on or about the 20th of September. I said, we're going to war with Iraq. Why? He said, I don't know. He said, I guess they don't know what else to do. So I said, well, did they find some information connecting Saddam to al-Qaeda? He said, no, no. He says, there's nothing new that way. They just made the decision to go to war with Iraq. He said, I guess it's like we don't know what to do about terrorists, but we've got a good military and we can take down governments. And he said, I guess if the only tool you have is a hammer, every problem has to look like a nail. So I came back to see him a few weeks later, and by that time we were bombing in Afghanistan. I said, are we still going to war with Iraq? And he said, oh, it's worse than that. He said, he reached over on his desk, he picked up a piece of paper, and he said, I just got this down from upstairs, meaning the Secretary of Defense's office today, and he said, this is a memo that describes how we're going to take out 7 countries in 5 years, starting with Iraq and then Syria, Lebanon, Libya, Somalia, Sudan, and finishing off Iran.
Okay. Now, what do you make of that, knowing in advance that they had the idea that they were going to go into Syria and Libya, and they have?
As I said, this is a plan that goes back to the 1990s, and it actually goes all the way back to a document that Paul Wolfowitz and others prepared for the government of Israel the first time that Benjamin Netanyahu was elected prime minister in Israel. And they proposed something very, very similar. The document was called a clean break. Israel didn't like it because part of the clean break was that they should also make a clean break with U.S. military aid, which they didn't think was such a great idea. The same group of neocons then formed an organization called the Project for a New American Century, and it produced a very similar suggestion and brought this to Bill Clinton. And Bill Clinton said, no, thank you, we don't want it. So when George W. Bush was elected and after September 11th happened, they saw another opening to bring this same plan that they had had for, you know, 15, 20 years at that point to a new administration. And that new administration said, oh, yeah, we like that. And so, yeah, I think there's no question about it. The only thing I can say about it is that in addition to everything else, it's stupid because clearly it hasn't worked. If the goal was to actually be able to put new regimes in place that would be more pliant with the United States' desires, you know, this is, I don't use the word evil easily, but essentially what this is a plan to destroy the lives and the infrastructure and the hopes of millions and millions of people for a plan that, in addition to everything else, wasn't even going to work. So, yes, we have managed to create states that have contributed to, you know, we have destroyed Libya. And as I say, I had absolutely no brief for Muammar Gaddafi. But creating a completely failed state has not been an improvement in the lives of ordinary people living in Libya. It has created a situation in which U.S. and other military ordnance has found its way all the way into the hands of groups like Boko Haram, all the way in East Africa. None of this has actually served even the interests that these people are pretending it served. So I honestly think what we've got here is a group of very, very small-minded men with very big and very dangerous weapons who've decided that the way that they are going to send messages to each other is with the lives of other ordinary human beings, especially, let me say frankly, ordinary women and children who are just trying to live their lives. And I say this as somebody who's been a political activist her whole life and who absolutely opposes authoritarianism in all of its forms. The older I get, the more I see of war, the more I become convinced that the only hope for changing authoritarian regimes is massive and nonviolent response. And the truth is that when you decide to go down the road of nonviolence, what you're saying is fewer people will die and more of them will be on your side. But I think that's the only hope for the Middle East. It's the only hope for Palestine. And it's the only hope here in our own country.
Professor Rebecca Gordon, thank you for being on. You've given us a lot to think about, and we appreciate your insights. Bye. I'm Gary Nall. I want to thank you all for listening. I look forward to sharing more on our next program. Have a nice day, everyone.